This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Just last night, the federal government released its first guidelines for driverless cars. This announcement could signal big changes for the automotive industry as federal regulators climb on board with this new mode of transportation. Tech and auto companies cheered the government's move because self-driving cars are already hitting the streets. Tesla and Google have both tested them out on the road, and this summer, Uber gave its customers a chance to hail a ride from a driverless car in Pittsburgh. Today in The Exchange, major milestones for self-driving cars and major questions that remain. Let's hear from you. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. We have two guests. Andrew Kuhn is with us in studio, professor of electrical and computer engineering at UNH. He's been looking at these self-driving cars. Andrew, it's nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Also with us from San Francisco, Alex Davies, transportation editor for Wired Magazine. Alex, thanks for getting up early and being on the air. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, Alex, let's start by talking about these new guidelines. This just happened last night. The Obama administration seems to be really encouraging self-driving cars, releasing the guidelines, saying some very positive things. The president himself published an editorial in the Pittsburgh Gazette saying, you know, hurrah for you for opening this up with Uber. What does that say to you, Alex, that federal regulators seem so enthusiastic?
It says that they're finally getting on board with this technology that for so long to so many people seemed like science fiction, seemed like something out of the Jetsons, but that over the last couple of years, independent parties have pushed so hard that it's really getting to the point where it's a practical thing that can be implemented and is already being implemented. So with federal guidelines saying, this is how we want to govern this, this is the kind of thing we want to see on safety, here are the kinds of laws we have in mind, here's how we imagine the federal government working with the state government, working with the local government, it's starting to build a framework, and that's the clearest evidence we have yet that this is something we really need to prepare for and that we should be excited about having.
And Alex, worth noting that, you know, often when companies hear federal regulations, they say, oh, no, but in this instance, industry kind of wanted federal regulations, right? Otherwise, we'd have this state-by-state patchwork.
Especially the big automakers wanted regulations. I think maybe if you talk to Google or Uber, they're less excited about the idea of having the government coming in and saying, hey, here's how to make machine learning work, because it's really not their area. But the issue here is that because individual states have the rights to make individual laws governing this kind of technology, it presents a unique challenge for automakers making cars that drive themselves because, you know, if you're making a Mercedes-Benz, it doesn't matter if the speed limit in California is 55 and in New Hampshire it's 75 because you're making the same car. But if you're making a self-driving car software and the states are totally different from one state to the next, that can really trip you up. So they've been waiting for the federal government to step in here and say, okay, everybody, this is how we're all going to do it.
Andrew, what do you think, the idea that not only did the federal government say, okay, here are the guidelines, but pretty enthusiastic about this technology?
Yeah, the NHTSA administrator, Mark Ruskin, was in Boston maybe 6 months ago or so, and he was really clear on this, that what they're worried about.
National Highway Transportation Safety Agency.
Correct. And just what Alex was saying, so if you have different regulations in different states, that is a roadblock, and now you don't have a 300 million person market, you have a, you know, 4 million or 1 million market, and that's a big roadblock. So they really want to get ahead of each state making their own different rules, and they want to help this process along. So this is exciting.
And the other thing that companies seemed excited about, Andrew, was that these were guidelines, not necessarily hard and fast regulations. From your technical expertise, it must just be a brave new world for a regulator when you have this technology that's just still evolving. How do you even begin to regulate something like, you know, if a driverless car hits a bicyclist, you know, is the car at fault? Is the driver at fault? Is the company at fault?
Yeah, and I don't think that we have the answers to that. But again, as Alex was really pointing out really well, you shouldn't regulate the technology to very, very deep detail. But you're trying to look at the grand picture of safety, perhaps, right? So if you have 30,000 deaths a year, you know that there's a safety problem on the roads right now. So how could you help that move along in a better direction with perhaps automated vehicles?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because just stepping back, guys, and Andrew, you first, what is the overall goal here? I mean, what's the promise of these cars that is getting a lot of people, including the federal government, excited?
I think there are multiple issues here, right? One is definitely safety. So on the one hand, people are really good drivers. I mean, realistically, I was driving today from Durham to Concord, and I saw a person behind me weaving in the road, and I'm pretty sure he was texting. And so I just really try to pull over and let people go. But realistically, even people who text happily do not end up in accidents. So it's amazing what people can do, right? Even though they really, really shouldn't do this. But the fact is, most of the time, it's the person who's at fault. And in some situations, at least, we can clearly see that computers could do better. And, you know, looking down the road, are we 100 years from today still going to be driving our own cars? It's interesting. I was reading an Isaac Asimov book, Caves of Steel. So that's set, 3,000 years in the future? But people still drive their own cars.
Oh,
so I was a little
really?
Surprised about that. You know, we have these amazing robots who can think like humans, but we still drive our cars. So I don't really believe that that's going to be the case. We're probably going to have self-driving cars that are going to help us with safety. But also, they imagine how well I could have used my time coming from Durham to Concord.
Right.
I could have been preparing for this interview. You know, I could have been reading some papers. I could have been grading my students' work. So it really would have been fun if I could have had that hour and the hour back to myself.
Well, I have another question for you there, but I want to ask you too, Alex, what's the big goal? I mean, why bother with all this? Besides the fact that it's cool, what are we really accomplishing here?
The biggest goal, right on the face of it, is safety. Anybody who's working on self-driving cars is going to rush to tell you that the reason they're doing this is that more than 1 million people die worldwide in car crashes every year, and that in the U.S. that number is more than 33,000, and actually in 2015 it spiked up.
Yeah, there was a record. We did a whole program on that. Go ahead.
Yeah, so that's part of it, and that's really, I think, why the DOT is so into it, because, and especially if you look at NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, their explicit goal is to make driving safe. And so that's why they're excited about this technology, because they see this potential. I think automakers are into it because they understand that this is where the technology is going, and that if they don't keep up, they're going to be outraced by Google and Uber and Lyft. And I think that the tech companies are into it because they see it as a new space where robotics and deep learning and artificial intelligence are really going to make a difference. And those are their key competencies. And so that's where they want to be.
Well, and in his editorial in the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, the president said self-driving cars could save tens of thousands of lives a year, and that the new policy that his department put out is flexible and designed to evolve with new advances. So are we just really bad drivers, Alex? I mean, is that it?
Yeah. Oh, we're terrible drivers.
Computers are better, because I think most people think, well, I'm a better driver than a computer.
I think that humans are, it's an interesting binary, because we tend to oscillate between being really excellent drivers. When a human is paying attention, when a human is well-trained, those are the skills that's really hard for a robot to match. A human can think in these creative ways, and we do it effortlessly without even understanding that we're doing it. We can analyze situations, know, you know, just by the way a cyclist or a car or a pedestrian is coming in, we have a good sense of what they're going to do and how to react. But we're also so easily distracted. Humans get drunk and they get tired and they get angry. And the undeniable advantage of the robot driver is that none of those things happen. Now it's just bringing them up to the level to have the understanding of the road and how to behave that humans naturally have.
The Exchange phone number for you to join us with your questions and comments about self-driving cars, especially if you've ever taken a ride in one, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Again, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-6477. NHPR. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're talking about self-driving cars. Lots of big developments just in the past year in terms of the technology and the testing of these cars. And then, as we've been saying, the federal government released guidelines just last night on self-driving cars. You know, a couple more questions on the goal of these cars and why we're bothering to do this. And I think to you next, Andrew, the other goal that you cited is using your time effectively. And I think the administration also mentioned this in its release, that people's commutes can become productive and fun. And you said you could have prepared for, you know, the show today and so forth on your way over. You could make the same argument about trains and buses. What do self-driving cars do to public transportation?
I totally agree. And it would be nice. I think a lot of people that I talk to say, well, we really should have more trains. And I agree. I love trains. And the question, though, is, are we, you know, what is exactly the goal? That's your question, right? So the goal is perhaps to have better use of your time. And trains allow you to do that, but so would self-driving cars. So it's not evident that you need trains. You need a way to get your time to be used better, right? So, and I think trains are one way to do that. And then self-driving cars are another way to do that might be more appropriate in certain situations. So a train will take me perhaps from Durham to Boston, but within Boston, you know, I will still have to then walk or take a cab or something like that. And that might be more or less convenient, right? So there, a self-driving car, again, will become very handy. Also, it's a question of infrastructure, right? So the infrastructure, for better or worse, is there in the United States of America for cars, whereas it isn't there for trains. So a quicker way, perhaps, to regain, you know, mastery of our time might be the self-driving cars route.
Here's the third promise that promoters of self-driving cars put out there. Again, one is safety. Two is, as you say, Andrew, better use your time. Three, Alex, I often hear this is self-driving cars will help reduce traffic. So how does that happen, especially if people are, you know, opting for cars over buses and trains?
That's, I believe, the kind of thing that only really happens once you have a critical mass of self-driving cars on the road. Although even with a few, it'll start to get better. At the very least, fewer accidents should pretty much always mean more traffic. But in terms of just moving around a city, the idea is that once these cars, and part of this, it's not just self-driving cars, it's also cars that communicate with one another. Just sort of a related but parallel technology that the federal government is also interested in supporting. Once a lot of cars can do that, the thinking goes that you can have those cars run more closely together because you're not worried about human reaction times, you know, with hitting the brake pedal. So you can run cars closer together, and so all of the space on the road becomes more efficient, and that makes all of traffic itself more efficient.
What do you think about the question I asked Andrew, Alex, whether self-driving cars spell the death of trains and buses?
No, I agree with Andrew that I think that this will ultimately become a part of a system, because self-driving cars, I think, especially when we're talking about fully autonomous cars, the early stages, it looks like, are going to be really focused in cities. That's why Uber launched in downtown Pittsburgh. That's where the idea of a service like Lyft and Uber has the most appeal, and thus the idea of a robotic version of one of those services has the most appeal. But at the very least, it's going to take a long time for these things to take effect, so we're not going to see the end of traditional public transit just yet.
Again, the exchange phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Today in the exchange, we're getting the latest on self-driving cars. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And guys, here's an email from Tim, who says he's executive director of the Bike Walk Alliance of New Hampshire. Tim asks, what percentage of crashes are due to driver error? Are autonomous vehicles expected to have a significant impact on the car crash rate? I think you guys already address that the belief is that self-driving cars will crash less. But here's his other question, which I do want to throw at you, maybe Andrew first. Will autonomous vehicles sense, see pedestrians and cyclists? I read just yesterday that self-driving cars have an especially hard time with cyclists because it kind of looks like a car on the bottom and a person on the top.
Right. So I guess the quick answer is yes, because obviously unless they do, they will not be safe. So by definition, they'll have to do that. Now, the technology exactly, I think, is pretty tricky. And I have to admit, you know, it's not my expertise exactly how that will work. On the other hand, you clearly have to do it, right? Unless you can sense those things know you're not going to have self-driving cars on the road.
So they can see and sense other things besides other cars on the road.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. So in a sense, it's not that complicated, right? So you have various sensors such as, you have the visual sensors like cameras, but also LiDAR and radar and so forth, right? And sonic sensors. So combining all these signals, yes, you can basically understand, you know, they have these so-called signatures, right? So a pedestrian might reflect sound differently than, say, a tree or nothing, right? And then that's how you can tell that there's a pedestrian or a bicyclist in front of you.
Well, Tim, I really appreciate the question. It's an important one. And it seems like, Alex, that self-driving cars are a little easier to figure out on the highway than in town. I mean, Tim raises a good point. In town, there's people walking dogs and people crossing the street and people on bikes and kids on scooters. And there's just a lot for a self-driving car to absorb.
Yeah, highways are actually relatively easy because they don't really have intersections. They don't have traffic lights. They don't have people walking or biking on them. Cities are definitely more complicated. But I think the reason you see automakers going to cities is that requires more accomplished technology. And especially if you look at Google, for example. So for years, automakers said, yes, we're interested in autonomous technology, but we still believe in the traditional person buys car, person drives car model. And we're just going to start implementing tools one by one that make their lives easier. You know, we're going to make a car that you drive most of the time, but then when you get on the highway, you can hit autonomous mode and it takes over. And if the weather gets bad or a sensor breaks, then you take back over. That model is looking a lot less trustworthy these days because people have started to explore the problems inherent in switching control between a human and a car. And it's that if we're bad at paying attention when we're supposed to be driving, the idea of a human as a backup driver does not offer much comfort. And so then the necessary move, then, if you want to keep working within the autonomous space, is working on cars that can drive themselves in all conditions. And if that's your goal, then you have to be able to work within a city because that's a condition and it's the hardest one. So it's, in a weird sense, kind of a place to start.
Right, and that was the excitement about Pittsburgh, is it has bad weather, it has hills, it has bridges, it has curvy roads and so forth, right,
and
Alex?
Walkers.
Yeah, and you spent some time there, didn't you, to check out the self-driving car scene?
Yeah, I was in Pittsburgh last week when they launched their self-driving car program, and it was really interesting to see how the cars operate in those conditions. You know, I've been in a few self-driving cars before. Most of the time it's been in Mountain View, the weather is always perfect. They're kind of these broad suburban roads.
That's where Google is, right, in California?
That's where Google is, yes. And that's where most of the automakers have set up Silicon Valley research labs, which is a move they've pretty much all made within the last few years. Pittsburgh is a very different environment. It's got like a million bridges. It's got these windy streets. It's got people all over the place. And so it's exciting to see someone tackling those conditions.
Well, and to you, Andrew, what's the range of self-driving or the range of automation in these cars? You know, Alex touched on it. 100% you sit back and, you know, read the newspaper, look at your Facebook feed, whatever. 50% you can maybe chill out and lean back, but you got to keep your eyes on the road and your hands on the wheel or ready to get on the wheel. What's the range that we see?
In the end, I think Alex was saying this too. It seems to me that you pretty much have to have full automated driving for it to be really useful. For you to sit there and observe what's going on, I think that's actually counterproductive because we will not do so well as humans sitting there waiting for something to happen and then take over.
Well, and the expectation there is that you're paying attention, but if the whole point of a driverless car is to not pay attention, then
it's counterproductive, right? People, I'm pretty sure what's going to happen is you're going to say, it's fine. Right? Let me check my Facebook feed.
People are doing that already when they're supposed
exactly.
to be paying attention. We'll talk more in just a moment. And we have a security expert from Dartmouth chiming in on this. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, self-driving cars are here, but many say the technology has a long way to go. We're looking at that and the new federal guidelines that the government just came out with on self-driving cars in a rather enthusiastic way, supporting the idea of self-driving cars as improving traffic safety on our highways. The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. Would you drive a self-driving car, or are you committed to keeping your hands on the wheel for the foreseeable future. What are some of the issues that you think come up with self-driving cars? Do you think they will benefit society as much as some people say? 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Our guests for the hour are Alex Davies, transportation editor for Wired Magazine. He joins us from San Francisco. Andrew Kuhn's in studio with me. He's a professor of electrical and computer engineering at UNH. And joining us now from Hanover is Sean Smith, professor of computer science and director of the Institute for Security, Technology, and Society at Dartmouth. Sean has a forthcoming book called The Internet of Risky Things, Trusting the Devices That Surround Us. Sean Smith, great to have you. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Well, so America, right, Sean? The land of the car, the land of the automobile, the land of the road trip, the land of the open road and the highway. How does this change things if we no longer are, you know, getting behind the wheel and taking off down the road?
Let's see. We have 40 minutes left in the session.
Really.
Well, I guess a couple. One of the things, I guess Alex had mentioned, there's a potential for greatly reduced fuel usage. There's also the potential if we can get away from either a person owning a car or at least an autonomous car that can go park somewhere else. And we have this huge infrastructure costs in the U.S. and elsewhere from parking spaces and the amount of traffic that exists in cities just for cars looking for parking. Well, cars with drivers in them looking for parking. So if you can imagine a world where a car was autonomous enough you could, you know, get to where you want to go and say goodbye, and it goes off somewhere and comes back when you need to leave.
Comes back and does something else more productive instead of just
sitting there. At least it's away and not having to consume all this paved space close to your buildings and stores and homes for parking. And then take a step further to say, well, what if it's doing something else? You know, so what if instead of owning a car, you just sort of borrow one and then it goes off and is used by someone else, the number of cars needed can go way down and the way they're manufactured can change. And this is something, I'm glad you mentioned my book, but I feel I should tout here. My friend Peter Weiner has a book, Future Ride, where he, very accessible, not a super technical book, but where he explores a lot of these implications of if we move from a world of each person has a personal car that's parked most of the time, to we share these autonomous cars, a lot of things can change.
So a lot of the promises, and we talked about these in our first segment, Sean, you know, a greener society, a more productive society, a calmer society. People are, you know, happy hanging out in their cars instead of frustrated and stressed out. A safer society, less traffic accidents, less traffic on the roads to begin with. How much of these promises, Sean, should we buy, and how much of them are kind of, well, we should look at skeptically?
I guess it's hard for me to answer that because I'm wired in two directions. One, to look at everything skeptically, but then also to be excited about the potential of things. So I guess a skeptical angle I'm concerned about, and we see this already, is as you put computing and computing machines into more and more things connected to our physical lives, like all the cars driving down the road, the attack surface, the places where, gee, if the designers didn't get it exactly right, someone else can come in and poke that and make it do something, greatly expands.
So the potential for hacking, is that what you mean?
Well, for hacking of all kinds, of various kinds. I have a colleague at SRI who's a government think tank who's very much concerned about the potential of imagine a terrorist plants a bomb and has casualties, and the first responder vehicles that are racing in to take care of that suddenly have had their brakes disabled. And then you have a second wave as the fire trucks crash into the victims.
That's
he's
really
very much concerned
creepy.
That's something of deep concern. Do we suppress, or even just a passive thing, not just manipulating the car, but being able to detect when this car goes by versus another. That could be useful for, you know, very intelligent IEDs in certain countries where we have operations right now. And the same friend actually is concerned, himself is a cyclist out in the Mountain View area, and he says he always gets very nervous when he's at an intersection with the Google cars because he can't, there's no driver to make eye contact with. So he doesn't know what the car is going to do.
Well, speaking as a cyclist myself, you don't get a lot of eye contact from people either. So I don't know about that. But yeah, you're raising some really serious issues about, you know, use of the system, the technology for ill intent. And Alex Davies, I wonder what you think, too, the potential for hacking.
Well, there's definitely serious potential for hacking. I think that one important thing to keep in mind is that there's also potential to hack today's cars. You know, today's cars run so much code that, you know, the same vulnerabilities are there. But I certainly think the stakes get higher with autonomous vehicles. And so which is why when you look at these newly released federal guidelines, the feds are saying, hey, like, basically they run down a list of 15 points and they say these are 15 concerns about how this technology works, things like how do you detect pedestrians, how do you handle weather, and one of them is how do you handle cybersecurity. And it's not a question that's fully answered yet, but it's certainly something that the various players in here are thinking about or at least concerned about.
All right, guys, let's go back to our listeners. And Nathan's joining us from Derry. Go ahead, Nathan. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning. Thank you. Well, kind of already touched on it, but I was just curious what precautions are being taken to protect against potential hackers. Because he did mention just now that cars now are susceptible, and I saw a TED Talk where they covered how people were able to disable braking systems of cars nowadays. So I was just curious.
Yeah, it's a good question and a big one. And I wonder if you want to jump in too, Andrew Kuhn, on the idea of how hackable might these self-driving systems be.
I have to admit, I know most of this from Sean because I we participated in an event together. But my understanding is that they are pretty hackable. And for example, I'm an affiliate faculty member at Volpe down in it's a Department of Transportation lab in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they do a lot of work on trying to understand how you can hack things. And you know, as was pointed out, there's a lot of computing power. There are networks in the car, and if you find the right way to get on in that network, then you can hack them. Now, happily, at least some of those networks are pretty complex, and in a sense, you know, car manufacturers actually build a lot of these things that go into cars specifically for model years or for models, which actually act as sort of a protection. So it's inconvenient when you're trying to do things like what we've tried to do in the past at UNH to design systems that will allow multiple aftermarket devices to talk on the same network within the car. However, the inconvenience of the network then might help prevent some of these hackers as well.
Because it changes from model year to model year.
Correct.
Yeah. Do you want to jump in on that, Sean, too?
Well, yes, I guess as Andrew mentioned, that's kind of the allegory of biodiversity, that the more different genomes are out there, the smaller the population that any particular attack vector can get to. But I think it's not just a problem with, well, I guess to bring up Alex's point, it's not that when we have autonomous cars in some distant point in the future, everything will be different. It's there already is a lot of electronics, a lot of computing, and it's a continuous progression, and the problems exist already, both in what we have now and in any other thing we do with computing. It seems to be an endemic problem in the computing industry that it's hard to build things that don't have holes. It's hard to write regulations to test to kind of enforce safety there. There's more lines of code in my laptop here in front of me than the number keeps changing, but last I checked, than moving parts in 10 747s. Now, which gets more engineering effort? you would think the 747s are more complicated, but the laptop's more complicated. So that's a sort of, software systems are complicated things, and interesting things can happen. I mean, Alex could probably talk to his Wired colleague Andy Greenberg's experience last summer, where he had some hackers take over his car while he was driving it. What's interesting is a lot of those things had already been demonstrated on closed courses about 5-6 years ago by researchers at UCSD. But that made an impact in some circles, but not in, you know, Senator Markey didn't write his angry letters until the Wired article came out.
Wow. Alex, okay, you got to tell us about that. What happened?
Yeah, so Andy Greenberg, who's one of our security reporters, it was last July, he you know, was working with a couple of hackers or was in touch with a couple of guys who are working on this sort of research. And so they said, go ahead, you know, climb into this Jeep, get on the highway. And then he did it. And then from their laptops at home, they hit a few keystrokes and disabled his brakes.
Wow.
And then they put them back in. And Andy, I think after being a little bit worried while on the highway, was fine. But was the good thing to come out of that was that then, fortunately, those researchers, I guess, would fall under what you call white hat hackers. They were, fortunately for everybody, not trying to kill Andy. They were trying to expose vulnerabilities. And so after the Jeep hack, Chrysler ended up recalling 1.4 million vehicles and updating the software on those to kind of plug the hole that they had found into their system. The problem is that there are going to be almost certainly a lot of holes like that. And you have to hope that the cybersecurity community and the automakers are going to be willing to work together to do that research and to make these cars safe. And there are worrisome signs that that's not exactly happening as much as people would like it to. For example, Michigan is working on a couple of cars relating to self-driving, and most of them seem very encouraging, like Michigan, Detroit wants to reclaim the mantle of innovation. But there's also a point in there that says somebody who hacks into a car system, regardless of their intention or what they're doing, could face prison for life. And so it's the way we talk about cybersecurity, I think, hasn't been fully nailed down yet.
Let's take some more calls, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Today in The Exchange, we're looking at self-driving cars. The federal government has just released new guidelines for automated vehicles. Tech and auto companies are already moving ahead, testing these cars on the road in some cities around the country. Boston, by the way, apparently has some testing coming up. Let's hear from you, your comments, concerns, questions. And if someone just gave you a self-driving car, would you drive it? Or, excuse me, sit in it. 1-800-892-6477 is our number. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And gentlemen, Dave is in Hopkinton. Hi, Dave. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
So, yes, we have the potential for a more safe and more productive society, but we already live in a more litigious society. So who owns the liability if my self-driving car causes damage?
This is a great question, Dave. Thank you so much. And Sean Smith, maybe to you, if his self-driving car, you know, hits and hurts someone, who's responsible? Is it him? Is it the car maker? Is it the system? Is it the network? What?
Well, responsible in the sense of the English term, who actually contributed to the thing happening, or responsible in the sense of what the law system in our country or some other country would decide, because they're not always the same thing. To look at another friends of mine, including myself sometimes, who work in medical IT, there's a large number of cases where essentially, defective design of a piece of electronic equipment in a hospital killed someone. But the way the purchase contracts and everything and the law is all set up, it's not the responsibility of the user interface designer. It's a responsibility of the person who is using it. And in fact, some of the contracts are set up so that they're not even allowed to publicly discuss these flaws. So, setting up a law and policy so that we actually have effective legal pressure for companies to act responsibly, it's a messy problem.
Wait, Sean, let me make sure I have this right. So, if a medical device is flawed and it ends up hurting someone, the doctor is liable, not the maker of the medical device?
If the computer, for a computerized medical device, if there's a problem in the computer software.
I see.
There's this hold harmless clause, and it's been established where it's not the maker who's responsible. I can dig up some citations for that if you're interested for other things. A related angle would be, the lying VWs, the VWs that were detected when they were, now we're being tested for emissions, so we'll emit legal amounts of emissions. Oh, now we're on the road, so now we'll release lots. 15 years ago, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was passed by Congress and came law and made it illegal for people to circumvent certain kinds of electronic controls. In theory, it would be illegal for someone to have opened up the code in the VW and looked for this. So it's sort of, you know, if we had a DMCA for automobiles in general in 1970, then we'd all still be driving Corsairs and Ralph Nader would be in prison.
Right.
So I guess,
wow.
Yeah, the long answer is we don't have a good track record as a society, and people who work in public policy and technology can talk your ear off about why it's a problem.
Well, I love the question, Dave. Thank you so much. What do you think, Andrew, real quick? Who's responsible if his self-driving car hits and hurts somebody?
This is a really complex question, and I think it becomes even more complex because it's not necessarily a question of error, but a question of a decision within the software. So, you know, my car might decide to go left or right knowing that either way it's going to get into an accident. So which way should it go, right? It might minimize the loss of life, but someone's life, it might have decided that, well, you know, there are only two people here and there are five people there. I'm going to go and mow over the two people and save the five people. So are the two people going to, you know, those two...
And we're trusting a computer to make that decision?
Well, you know, I mean, it's going to have to trust... Someone's going to have to make that decision. Should we trust a human? You know? So you're right, though. It's a very complex question. Of course, there is also the life of the person in the car. So if there's, you know, one of you and you're about to mow over five people, should you maybe drive into the wall? You know, the car might decide that you're the one who's dispensable in this particular case. What if it's five school children versus you? So it's really complex. I don't have the answers, but you're right. It's a complex question.
Wow. Sean, I can hear you want to jump in there.
Two quick points. One, yes, there's these, as Andrew is mentioning, ethicists and psychologists talk about these trolley problems, which are various sorts of artificial constructs where you have an unfortunate arrangement of people and runaway trains and choices to make. And humans are pretty funny about what choices they make in terms of, but now if we move all of that into a computer in your car making the choice, it adds a whole other angle. I have to run a few minutes. Another angle we haven't discussed with in terms of electronics and computation in cars is the amount of data the car can know about you, the amount of data. Alex mentioned Chrysler patched their cars by sending out USB thumb drives. Tesla patches their cars via the network connection they have to your car overnight, immediately. When the New York Times journalist a few years ago did a test drive of a Tesla and didn't like it and wrote a negative article, then Tesla released all this data from his car and said, gee, this disagrees with what you wrote. That opens up a whole bunch of questions.
Lots of privacy issues.
Can your car testify against you? And if it is testifying against you, is it telling the truth?
Oh, you know, so the car would say in a court of law, Sean, it's his fault, not my fault. I know you got to go, Sean. I want to thank you very much for being with us. We'll talk to you again.
Oh, thank you. And thank you, Andrew and Alex.
That's Sean Smith, professor of computer science and director of the Institute for Security, Technology, and Society at Dartmouth. His forthcoming book is called The Internet of Risky Things, Trusting the Devices That Surround Us. Coming up, a New Hampshire advocate for people with disabilities talks about his own trip in a self-driving car. We'll hear about that. Stay with us. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're looking once again at self-driving cars, some of the developments that have happened just in the past couple months, and more broadly at how they could impact our travel and our lives. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org, 1-800-892-6477. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Andrew Kuhn is with us, professor of electrical and computer engineering at UNH, along with Alex Davies, joining us from San Francisco, transportation editor for Wired Magazine. And guys, let's go right back to our listeners. And Gary joins us from Portsmouth. Hi, Gary. You're on The Exchange. Welcome. Gary in Portsmouth, are you with us? All right, Gary, I hope that you call back. Here's a couple concerns about how adaptable self-driving cars are. Bunch of emails, one from Alex who says, what are the implications of adverse weather conditions like those we commonly encounter in New Hampshire? Similar concern from Susan in Vermont, do driverless cars work on dirt roads? And then Steve on Plum Island, do these cars avoid potholes or slow down for speed bumps? Steve worries we could see an increase in car repairs. I think I'll turn to you first, Alex. You know, it's one thing to imagine a self-driving car smoothly going down a beautiful highway, but we've got some pretty funky road conditions here in New England.
Absolutely. To grab potholes and speed bumps first, that is something cars should be able to see. Using some of their sensors, especially what's called a LIDAR sensor, which is essentially a laser scanning system that works kind of like radar, but it's more accurate and gives you finer details. So you should be able to see those. Right now, I've been in self-driving cars that have hit potholes hard enough that it's safe to assume the car did not know it was there.
Really?
Yeah. And that's a hard thing to program into a car. They're already dealing with a lot. So I think right now they're not immediately worried about potholes. They're more worried about kind of the lower hanging fruit of just getting it through a city safely.
Well, and Alex, you mentioned your experience in Pittsburgh. Again, one of the reasons Pittsburgh was chosen is because it has, you know, East Coast, Northeast winter weather. What are some of the issues that might come up around Pittsburgh's experience in the ice and snow?
So one is that if it's snowing, those snowflakes can actually mess with the LIDAR detectors I just mentioned, which especially in city driving are among the more important or certainly a key sensor. So those work by sending out little beams of light. And when that beam of light hits a person or a traffic sign or a concrete post, it comes back to the car and the car says, okay, I know something's there. And it forms a map and you can actually see kind of this 3D map of the world the car makes. But snowflakes are actually big enough that they can mess with the way those beams bounce. And so all of a sudden the car is not quite sure. You know, the car needs to know that, yes, it can drive through a snowflake. It can't drive through a concrete post.
Go ahead, Alex.
That's an issue that they're starting to work out. And that's largely a software issue in terms of tweaking the LIDAR sensors so that the car understands their readings differently, but also combining things. You know, if the LIDAR says, hey, there's stuff here, but the radar, which doesn't detect snow or rain, goes right through it, then the car can probably reasonably say, okay, there's not actually something there, it's just snow.
Wow. Andrew, I got to ask you about this, too. Given the snow and rain and sleet and who knows what we see here in New England.
And we have a lot of that, right? So I think Alex is totally right. So there are a couple of things going on. One is this tweaking, right? So one aspect of tweaking is learning. And so if you hit a bump, right, and if your software is smart enough, then it will say, aha, that was a bump. Right. Well, what did I see just seconds or fractions of a second before I hit that bump? And then you can look at that data from various sensors. But also, Alex pointed out combining different sensors. So it might be that your LIDAR does not see something, but your radar will. And if you're smart enough about this and if you do this right, then you should be able to get around some of these issues of not being able to see through, let's say, snow, but with one particular type of sensor, but then being able to see through it, if you will, with another, or again, the combination of the multiple sensors might give you a better picture, if you will.
So just one sensor taking a picture is not enough. You might need multiple sensors that can sense multiple things.
That's definitely my expectation.
Well, joining us now is someone from New Hampshire who recently experienced a self-driving car and was very excited about it. Joining us on the phone is Clyde Terry. He's CEO of Granite State Independent Living and chairperson of the National Council on Disability. And Clyde, it's really nice to have you. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
And we should say you've been legally blind, right, your whole life, Clyde?
Yes.
So never been able to drive. You had the opportunity to be inside one of these new vehicles when you were on a trip to D.C. Now, how did that come about, Clyde?
Well, I'm not promoting any particular manufacturer, but indeed the Volkswagen Audi company reached out to the National Council on Disability because over the past 2.5 years, NCD has been researching this issue from the perspective of what are the great opportunities that autonomous vehicles can bring to 57 million Americans with disabilities. So I did have the opportunity to get in the car, and we crossed the bridge into Virginia, and they this was still sort of the computer-assisted model to hit the button, and suddenly the car just took off on the highways in Virginia and moved and changed lanes, left lane, sped up, slowed down, went up the exit ramp, ran around the Pentagon, stopped for a while, came back. And the fascinating thing is we're coming back across the 14th Street Bridge. Another car operated by a human cut us off literally by less than an inch. And
oh,
the self-driving car was able to detect it, slow us down. There was no rear end, and it wasn't planned. It was one of those moments that it could have been a different outcome had a human been operating the vehicle.
Well, and there's a lot of traffic in that area. So we should say, Clyde, you had a person in the vehicle with you.
Yes, during this, the engineer for Audi, I mean, they weren't going to give the blind guy from New Hampshire a $100,000 vehicle.
Right. So he was there just in case something happened.
Correct.
And in that instance that you talked about where you were abruptly cut off, he didn't do anything, though. He kept cool?
No, the car did it all. And,
wow.
And we had another photographer in the back that filmed the whole thing so we could document it later.
Do you want to jump in, Andrew Kuhn? Yeah.
Well, he probably couldn't have done anything. And that's actually kind of the I really like this Clyde brought this up, because in that particular instance, the computer was the better driver, right? If something happens so quickly that you have no time to react as a human, then the computer does have this advantage.
How is this different for you, Clyde, than from what you've experienced your whole life, which is somebody else driving you around? What's the difference?
Well, the difference is, for me, to be able to access the system, to potentially have a car or these, to go where I want to go, to maybe work wherever I want to work, where I'm not tied to public transportation, as you talked about earlier, as limited as it is in New Hampshire, but rather someone could live in Stoddard, New Hampshire, for example, and work in Concord. There's no bus, there's no train. They could use a vehicle like this to go back and forth if indeed they don't own a driver's license.
Well, and we got an email from Nancy in Durham who says these could be liberating for the elderly and disabled. Gary from Woodsville also emailed. He said, I am legally blind. Would I be allowed to be the sole occupant of an autonomous car? Alex Davies, what do you know about that?
So most of that is undecided for right now. Certainly a car that you would need to drive some of the time, but that drives itself some of the time, that's not going to be a car that someone with a driver's license can't legally operate. But certainly the potential is there to really change mobility for people who can't drive right now. And I think at least within cities, presumably once Uber's system is up and going, if you're a blind person or if you don't have – Uber doesn't ask for a driver's license because you're a passenger. So for a service like that, I think it's perfectly reasonable to assume that, yes, you'll be allowed to ride in the car because it's a car that's designed without a human backup in mind.
Hi, Laura, can I
Clyde,
jump
go ahead.
In here? Sure. I mean, that actually is one of the premises of the report that NCD delivered to the President and Congress, that we don't want policymakers creating artificial barriers that would interfere with the full development of this technology. Because it's exactly that question, that for all those folks that are blind or cerebral palsy or a developmental disability, you name it, that if we can get to 100% autonomy, it does open up the world and allows them to go where they want to go on their terms and not necessarily on anyone else's.
Well, and since you said that, Clyde, I'll have you respond to this tweet that James sent us. He says, why develop technology that perpetuates laziness instead of technology that might actually do some good, i.e. alternative energy? And James, thank you very much for the question. I wonder what you think about that, Clyde.
I don't think it perpetuates laziness at all. It creates opportunity. I mean, if you have someone who is living, let's say, in Plymouth, and they can't get a job because there's no jobs there, but the jobs are in Concord or in Portsmouth, this technology would allow them to commute to actually become productive rather than having to stay home and waiting for the opportunities to come to them. This way they can go seek out those opportunities, which right now they can't.
I have to ask you one last question, Clyde, and again, it's been great to talk to you. How worried are you? Let's say, 5 years in the future that Clyde Terry has his own self-driving car. How worried are you, Clyde, that if something happens in that self-driving car, you won't be able to grab control?
Safety has been used around the lives of people with disabilities for centuries. folks with disabilities can't live on their own. They can't live independently because, oh, it's unsafe. So this is just another iteration of that. So am I worried that something will happen? Something will happen if I'm in a car right now. That's the whole point, that maybe we can these are actually safer. So I'm not worried about that at all. I look forward to the day. In 5 years is 4.5 years too many. I'll wait till it gets here. But I do think it's exciting. It will create opportunities for folks with disabilities and those that are aging, and even folks that get tired and just want to go home and don't want to have to drive because they're exhausted from work all day.
Clyde, it's been really good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you.
That's Clyde Terry, again, CEO of Granite State Independent Living and chairperson of the National Council on Disability. By the way, we got another email from someone who says, I have been disabled for 20 years. I have a walking disability and tend to want to be left of center. So I can't wait for the freedom that a driverless car will give me. This is from Michael. Michael, thank you for the email. A bunch more emails here, guys. Here's one from Robert in Epsom. If the driverless car is programmed to maintain a safe distance from the car behind, will road-raged non-adapters be able to tailgate and force the driverless car to 10 or more miles over the speed limit rather than the commonly allowed 5 miles over the limit? Robert, thank you for the question. And Alex, it raises a broader question in my mind, this transition period. I mean, he's absolutely right. You know, even if you have 20% of the population in self-driving cars, you know, in 5 years or 2 years, you still have all these other people who are in regular cars, maybe getting mad and behaving badly with the self-driving cars. I don't know. The transition is difficult, Alex.
Sure. The transition is certainly difficult than if we could all of a sudden put purely self-driving cars on the road tomorrow. And I think that that's the vision a lot of people think about when they think about this technology, rather than one or two or 100 on the road mixed in with a greater population. And given how many millions of cars are on American roads and how long they usually last, it's going to take a long time to actually start replacing cars. I'm not sure I can speak to exactly how any one autonomous car would react to being tailgated. I think it's safe to say that they're all being programmed to drive very defensively. So on the highway, some of them, like Google and Uber, for example, say that they will program their cars to go a few miles over the speed limit just because they think that it's safer to be going the speed of traffic. I don't know how they react to somebody right on their tail, but it's not necessarily that they'll speed up. They might just keep going their speed and hope that somebody leaves them alone.
Well, and they won't be bothered by it, right? I mean, it's a computer.
Exactly. And so that rage that kid just grabs you when you're driving a car and you're like, who is this jerk who's tailgating me? There's none of that. It's just a robot saying, okay, there is an object there, there's an object there, and I'm doing my thing.
Go ahead, Andrew.
And it's also interesting to bring this up. So Alex mentioned the rate of replacement, which is relatively slow. So your car is probably going to last 10 plus years. However, many cars, probably all of the cars today, are really drive-by-wire. So that means that when you turn your steering wheel, it's not really that you're physically turning the wheel. You're actually issuing a command to a computer to turn on little motors, to turn a wheel, and so forth. So that means you can have aftermarket devices that will make your car automated, right? So in fact, automation might progress faster than it would if you had to buy a new car so that your car would be automated. There are companies right now vying for this business, right, to basically bring in automation to your existing non-automated vehicle.
Yes, let's clarify that a little bit, because I just saw that yesterday that, you know, while you might think, oh, I could never afford one of those, or, oh, it's a long way down the road. Yeah, talk a little bit more about that, Andrew. There are devices that aren't that expensive that you can put into your current car,
right,
to make it a self-driving car.
Well, so self-driving car needs many things, but one of the key things, obviously, is that a computer needs to be able to issue commands so that the car would do things like accelerate, brake, and steer. And realistically, those things are already in your vehicle, probably, because currently your car has little computers that when you turn the wheel or push a pedal, it's really talking to a computer, which then makes the car do things. So to make those actuators work, the computer could already do that. Now, you do need that smarts and you need the sensors, and that's where the companies come in. But your car is actually capable of doing these things.
Let's take one more call. This is Jennifer in Webster. Hey, Jennifer, we're nearing the end of the hour, so I'll ask you to keep it short, but thanks for being with us.
Thank you. I had heard or read at one point that the self-driving vehicles really started to for the trucking industry. not so much for individual driving, but for the trucking industry. And I'd like to know if that is the case and what that impact would have on our economy, because there's a tremendous amount of truck drivers out there.
Sure, good point. And also, Alex, all those people who drive for UPS and FedEx and all that.
Absolutely. I believe the number right now is that 3 or 4 million Americans are directly employed by driving in general, and I think the bulk of them are truck drivers. Certainly, companies are working on self-driving trucks. There's a startup called Otto, O-T-T-O, that's working on that. That was just acquired by Uber. Daimler has shown off a concept for a self-driving truck. Their concept, they're quick to say, does require a human driver inside. But there's so much potential for this technology, I think, that really makes sense for a commercial industry like trucking, where you don't have to convince individual members of the public that this is safe, that this works. If you can make an economic case to a trucking company, they're much more likely to say yes. That's not necessarily good news for truckers. I've heard the argument that if they're required to drive the truck just enough to get it onto the highway, but not actually do the driving on the highway, that then maybe they can pick up side jobs in between. They'll be doing something else from the cab of the truck. But it's not clear, but I think it's safe to say that in 10, 20 years that the trucking employment isn't going to be a job of the future.
Wow. Well, thank you for the question, Jennifer. It's a good one. And Craig also in Hopkinton worries about people like taxi drivers and truck drivers being out of work. I want to close with Greg in Lebanon, who says, our automated self-driving car sharing future cannot come fast enough as far as I'm concerned. Bring on the robots, Greg says. Greg, thank you for contributing that email. And Alex Davies and Andrew Kuhn, it was really good to have you too. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having
me.
This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees, or its underwriters.